Right. Hello. Thanks very much for inviting me. It's nice to be here. Now, I've been invited because of this article I wrote a few years ago. I'm going to revisit this article today, try and present some of the methodological and theoretical implications of the work I did on Frontex, this European Union Borders Agency. I'm also going to spend a few minutes talking about my work more generally, because I think it has, again, methodological and theoretical implications for work on security generally. How do we think about security? What is security? How do we understand it? So I'll pass this article around. You can flip through it if you like. So I must admit that this article is the only work I've ever done on migration. So I consider myself very much in the security camp, but not in the migration camp. So I hope to learn something about migration today. Don't ask me any detailed questions about migration policy, because other than what's in this article, I don't know. However, you can ask me anything about security. So, as I said, my real interest is in security. What is security? How should we understand security? How should we study security? What do people, what do actors understand when they engage in security policy making, security practice? What do they do? And the argument of the paper I wrote in Frontex was that securitization, this increasingly popular concept, approach, theory, is not really adequate for understanding the nature of security practices. And actually, this is an argument I continue to make in my current work. And today, like I said, I'm going to revisit that old argument. So some general methodological points, questions, problems. I have a background as a theorist, originally international relations theory, more accurately security theory. But these days my work is increasingly empirical, and I think this is fundamentally important for how we understand security and security practices. I think what we need is empirically informed theoretical work, and at the same time theoretically informed empirical work. The two have to go together, I think. And in the book which I recently published, Exceptionalism and the Politics of Counterterrorism, well, it's basically a book-length study of the dominant theoretical debates about liberty and security after 9/11. In particular, I looked at arguments about sovereign decisionism, sovereign exceptionalism, which have become very popular. And I tried to critique what I thought were the dominant themes of security debate, both within academia but also in practice itself. So questions about state security, state declaring security threats, this is where sovereign decisionism comes in, and the state dealing with security threats. What is the relationship between the declaration of security threats, discourses of threats, and the means for dealing with them? Now, already probably some of you can see that that does relate to securitization theory. But I think securitization theory has predecessors. It draws on a previous body of work. It draws on, let's say, Thomas Hobbes, for example. It draws particularly on Carl Schmitt, this sometime Nazi legal theorist who wrote a great deal, well, not actually a great deal, some very sharp comments he wrote about the nature of sovereign power. Securitization theory, I think, adds to that body of work, but it adds a discursive element, a constructivist element, and an intersubjective element. And I'll come back to those in a second. Now, the conclusion of my book was basically the same conclusion I made in the Frontex article, which is that understanding security in a, let's say, a state-centric way, but more likely a sovereign-centric way, reinforces the assumption that the state is actually in control of this thing called security. It reinforces the idea that there is essentially a singular, unified, dominant actor in the security realm. And one of the problems with this, to quote Judith Butler, is that this fails to give the lie to sovereign power. It fails to really critique how power works, how security power works properly. And this feeds into a second problem. That actually security practice isn't really like that. It doesn't really exist in the way that Schmitt describes it. It's not all about the sovereign decision, or in the updated securitization theory terms, it's not always about the elite's decision to name security threats and effectively construct and modulate the discourse around security threats. Now, in my current work, much more empirical, I'm looking at counter-terrorist lawmaking. The making of counterterrorism law. as a security practice, particularly in the UK, but hopefully that case study has implications for elsewhere as well. And I think many would assume that this is another form of sovereign decisionism, essentially, that to make new security laws is another decisive action on security, another act of sovereign decisionism, another construction of security, if you like. But my main problem with this is that it neglects the legislature, can I say that word, as an actor, and the complex relationship between the executive and legislature. This relationship is complex, highly structured, it's institutionalised, there are complex rules of the game, it's historical, there are conventions, dispositions that actors involved in that field work through, and it's political. It's not just a struggle over security, but it's a political struggle. Perhaps overtly in the public discourse, there is a struggle over what are security threats, what should we do about them, and this again feeds into the debate about securitization. But I think underneath that, there's a hidden political struggle. Parties are vying for electoral advantage, vying for to hold objective office and so on. Now, this is a slight digression, but I want to draw on those methodological lessons with regard to migration particularly. And the main methodological conclusion from my current work is this. We need to disaggregate the actors that we're analysing in security studies. Really, I think we could put it in simplistic terms. There's no such thing as the state as far as security is concerned. Now, of course, the state exists as a historical entity and so on. But so much of the literature, even the very best literature, treats the state as the only actor, more or less. And I'm not talking about the distinction between state and non-state actors, which is a very IR way to do things. I'm talking about the distinctions within this thing we call the state. The relationship between the executive and the legislature is one of them. The relationship in the European Union, and this is what I'll come to in a second, is even more complicated. It makes it impossible to talk about the state as an actor, or even any singular security actor like the European Union, for example. And therefore, by implication, it makes it very difficult to talk about security in terms of state practice, state decision, state policy. Practices are always interesting, unique, unusual. They have to be looked at in their specificity. And I think it's a disservice to put them under a single logic, whether that's state security, to follow the IR conventions, or even the securitization conventions. Okay, onto the Frontex paper. So Frontex was created in 2004, and the main argument of the paper was that it wasn't the result of the securitization and migration after 9/11. This is quite a counterintuitive argument. Actually, I think the creation of this agency was the result of the failure of the securitization and migration. So it goes very much against the prevailing assumption that migration has been securitized after 9/11. I suppose the dominant theme of this whole seminar series. Now, theoretically, methodologically, try to pick some holes in the debate about securitization. What do we mean by securitization? I think, really, in the wider debates, there are probably two meanings these days. One is that securitization is used increasingly loosely, just that people want to suggest, imply, critique the fact that many things, aspects of political, social life, are becoming more and more associated with security. They're becoming more and more security-ish, to put it crudely. But there's a second, more specialised literature. Scholars who have really gone into close critique, close development, close revision of the Copenhagen School approach to securitization theory. And in contrast to the loose discourse of securitization, the second debate has become increasingly technical. And into two strands, actually. A very linguistic version of the theory, which focuses on the grammar of security, illocutionary speech acts, perlocutionary speech acts, and so on. And a second, more sociological strand, which looks much more at context, institutions, the rules of the game, the construction of authority, and so on. And this is the side that I'm more interested in, actually. And it's huge literature, and I think it actually has a danger of becoming increasingly self-enclosed, too specialised, closed to outsiders almost. In the classical version of the theory, the Copenhagen school version of the theory, if you like, securitization depends on three things, or implies three elements. First is the speaker. Who speaks security? Who declares security threats? Who declares, modulates the discourses around security? And this is quite an elitist aspect of the theory. I think this draws heavily on Carl Schmitt. Now, some people would contest that. But I think there's strong grounds for arguing that securitization theory in its classical form does tend to focus on political leaders, sovereigns, executives, and so on. Methodologically, in the wealth of case studies that have been done, I think too much work focuses on, let's say, the statements of political leaders, the public statements of political leaders. And I think this has a danger of diverting how we really need to study security practices. Now, the second aspect is audience. Who are the speakers speaking to? Who receives those securitizing speech acts? And this can be conceived in all sorts of different ways. The public, generally, or perhaps more specialized forms of audience like legislatures or other actors, maybe other technocrats. The important thing is this public, this audience, has to be mobilized in support of action against security threats. And in mobilizing, they lend a legitimacy to a particular construction of security threats. And then the third thing is a kind of exceptionalism. And this, again, has been challenged. All of these aspects have been challenged in the literature. But the exceptionalism in the Copenhagen School version of theory is that securitization needs to somehow invoke a kind of urgency, that somehow it needs to break normal rules or perhaps depart from normal rules, treat security issues in a special way, outside or beyond normal politics. And on top of these three elements, we can add also context, authority, social capital, facts on the ground, grammar, all these other areas that people are developing. So that's the basis of securitization theory, as far as I'm concerned. Now, the problem with the European Union, and this was how I approached the case study in the paper, was that the European Union doesn't necessarily meet any of these conditions. And let's go through them one by one. Who's the speaker? Who decides on security in the European Union? Is it the European Commission? Is it the member states individually? That's not the EU necessarily. Is it the European Council, consisting of all the member states in aggregate? Is it the European Parliament? It's extremely difficult to answer that. Maybe it's all of them. Maybe it's none of them. But the problem is, even if we can identify security discourses emanating from any of those institutions, any of those actors, even if we can identify in policy documents or public statements or, let's say, the minutes of meetings, clear securitizing moves, identifying threats, calling for urgent measures to deal with them, we don't necessarily know how those discourses are linked to outcomes. Is there any link between security discourses in the European Union institutions and securitized outcomes, policy changes, if you like? Secondly, audience. As far as the European Union is concerned, is anyone listening? Who is the audience of the European Union institutions? It probably isn't the European public. It certainly isn't the European public from my British perspective, where we get zero news about the European Union in any of our media, really. Perhaps, well, it's been suggested that the audience for securitizing discourses in the European Union are actually other technocrats, other individuals, groups, agencies, actors within the wider European Union field. It's really an internal dialogue, and I think there might be something to that. But nevertheless, if the audience is technocratic, then you have a problem of, well, where does identity come into this? If you go back to the Copenhagen School writings on societal security, that migration can easily be constructed as a security threat because it can be presented as a challenge to dominant notions of social identity, then securitizing discourses are meant to somehow feed into that, to reconstitute identity against threats. But European identity is at best a problem. I mean, Ole Weber himself argues this. There is no identity to constitute, really. It's European Union identity is an ideal, it's an ideal within European Union discourse generally, but it doesn't work in a kind of national mobilising context that the original theory was meant to suggest. And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, is there a capacity for exceptionalism in the European Union of any kind? And what I argued in the paper was that the European Union, none of the European Union institutions have the capacity to break rules, have the capacity to decide on the exception in Schmittian terms. And actually, I think the whole idea of exceptionism and breaking rules goes against the very raison d'etre of the European Union, which is meant to regulate and tame the capricious tendencies of states and the old forms of state sovereignty. So what we can see, even though empirically I showed that there are many examples of European Union actors, whether that means state leaders in a European context or Commission or Parliament, using securitising discourse, let's say Tony Blair after 9/11, let's say the Commission after 9/11, let's even say Sarkozy and Berlusconi in the last few months. It's very, very difficult to link those discursive elements to transformations in policy. So as I just mentioned, empirically we can show that the European Union did link migration with security in the aftermath of 9/11. There are clear securitising statements and documents and speeches that make calls to strengthen border technologies, border cooperation, that link migration with terrorism, crime, trafficking, and so on. So in that sense, in the initial stages, particularly, let's say, the year after 9/11, you have the beginnings of securitization. From an analytical point of view, you have the first ingredient, security speech acts. But then, interestingly, between 2001 and 2003, all the proposals that emanated from those securitising speech acts essentially evaporated. Any sense of urgency dissipated into business as usual. Business as usual for the European Union. Member state pet projects, pilot studies, internal politics, horse trading, compromises, blocking, technocracy. One of the key quotes that I built the paper around was from a European Commission official at a seminar I went to in 2006. I think Mulkins was there as well. This European Union European Commission official complained that after 9/11, the US built a mastodon, the Homeland Security Department, and we just disintegrated ourselves. So I call this the failure of securitization. And then interestingly, strangely almost, Frontex as an agency comes out of this failure. It isn't the securitization of the European Union borders. It isn't the creation of a European border police or the hardening of the borders. It's actually, well, at least in its origins, a non-controversial, non-exceptional compromise. A community agency controlled by both the Commission and the member states. And in its founding documents, in its remit, in its early practices, which do change, I'll mention that in a moment, there's almost no mention of security, no harking back to the securitising discourse that's post 9/11. Rather, Frontex is presented as a logical continuation of the integration project, going back to, let's say, the Treaty of Rome. We could give a more critical reading of this, saying that actually, migration from a European Union perspective has always been tightening, always been becoming more restrictive before 9/11, after 9/11. Frontex is simply a continuation of that process, and the pre-9/11 days were certainly no sort of haven for migrants. And Frontex can very much be read in the context of other European Union systems for managing migration, Schengen system, visa database, common European Union visa rules, and so on. All of these have something in common. They're all technological, technocratic programs that don't feed into the classic dramatic discourses of securitization that we find from the Copenhagen School approach. And then interestingly, Frontex itself and the way it works as an agency follows a completely different mentality, a completely different logic to that of securitization. It works through risk. Now this form of risk as a security practice isn't the kind of risk put forward by Ulrich Beck, for example. It's not, we're not talking about unpredictable catastrophes. Rather, it's more like how Aradan and Van Munster described it, a dispositif, an assemblage of practices, a collection of technologies geared towards a common problem. Or as Luis López Guerrero describes it, risk as a technology to make the ungovernable governable, to take contingent problems like security disasters, catastrophes and so on, and through technological procedures, making those into calculable political problems. And we can see this in how Frontex works. What does Frontex do? Okay, one, it does monitor migration. It monitors potential migration flows. It tries to anticipate where future movements of people might come from. But unlike classic discourses of state security and securitization, it's not in the business of responding to threats in a dramatic way. It's in the business of anticipating threats. It's a futures-oriented technological series of systems for anticipating where migration flows might come from. But then secondly, strangely almost, it also monitors states themselves. It monitors state capacities dealing with migration issues. It monitors the strengths and weaknesses of different state migration apparatuses to see where the holes are, where the weaknesses are. And in that sense, it's regulatory. It works in the way that other European Union institutions work, almost by benchmarking member state capacities and then trying to harmonise them and bring them up to a certain standard. Now, since its institution as an agency, in these rather non-controversial technocratic terms, other things have been added to its remit, its operation. In particular, through an amendment to its remit, it now has the capacity to create what it calls rapid border intervention teams, or RABITs. And these do look more like traditional dramatic security instruments. They're a way of rapidly mobilising, let's say, ships or planes or soldiers or whatever, to deal with sudden eruptions of, let's say, migration crises. But even this is rather minimal. In the context of migration in the European Union or into the European Union as a whole, these rapid border intervention teams have really been a very, very small part of the overall picture. Perhaps they're only really window dressing. And I would argue that Frontex continues to work in this mostly quiet, professional, technocratic way. It's not in the game of dramatic, discursive securitization of migration. It's perhaps more likely a form of biopolitics. It's involved in the management and the circulation of life. It's not intervening too much, not intervening too little, but somehow understanding the processes at work. And at the same time, coexisting with other forms of power, but perhaps still, old forms of sovereign power that dramatically intervene. But that's not its main modality. So the conclusion of my Frontex paper was that whatever security is, it can't be understood through a single overarching logic like securitization. Practices of security are too plural, too diverse, too decentered. Securitization does exist. Empirically, it does exist as a discursive spectacle in the public theatre of politics. But we can't necessarily assume a link between security discourse and security practice. Often there's a radical disconnect. Methodologically, we need to separate declarations of intent from political leaders in the public eye from the capability to act, the capability to do, the capability to put those declarations into practice. We need perhaps to separate those who speak in the public theatre of politics from those who act, those practitioners who act in the security arena. So finally, a few comments in response to this seminar series, meant in a friendly way, however critical they might sound. Responding to the call, it's very much framed in terms of securitization, desecuritization, state security, human security. And I would suggest that actually we need to go beyond those terms. It's not clear that the decisions of governments to securitize migration, to quote the call, really exist. Okay, perhaps the discourses exist. But decisions, I think, feeds back into the old Schmittian Copenhagen School securitization theory approach, which assumes that discourses of leaders are actually important as far as security practices are concerned. And I would not dispute the fact that there's been a tightening of migration over the years, going back, you know, before the current decade and the previous decade. But that tightening of migration should not necessarily be understood in terms of securitization as it's, you know, formally understood. So we need to question, what do we mean by securitization? Do we mean that migration has become, you know, somehow very generally associated with security? Or do we mean the formal analytical approach of securitization theory? And choosing that approach, choosing securitization as an analytical discourse, has implications, has methodological implications, has political implications. I think there's even a danger of masking what's really going on. It helps to reify the myth of sovereign decision and prevents us from looking at the minutiae of security practices out of the public eye. Desecuritization, well, actually, I think that's tied to securitization. It constructs the problem as one of securitization, and therefore a problem to be got out of. Perhaps that's not really the nature of the problem. And I think even human security, while I would support the ethical thrust behind it, again constructs this unhelpful binary between securitization, desecuritization, state security, human security. There's, I think, a risk in human security debates securitizing themselves, areas of social, ethical, and political life that should be values in their own right, human dignity, for example, or social equality. If we construct those as security problems, even from a human security perspective, then I think there is a danger of drawing those issues into security debates and distorting what the values behind those debates really should be in normative terms. So finally, very generally, I want to conclude by saying theory has consequences. Analytical frameworks have consequences. Methodology is political, particularly when we're trying to understand the nature of security. What is it? How is it done? How is it understood? What we need are painstaking, diverse, empirical studies of security practices, and to try and avoid totalising, overarching critiques of security or logics of security. I'll stop there. Thanks very much.
Thank you.